For May 1st, 2007, we'll come to order. Welcome to our committee on Law Day. Thank you so much for being here. Because of the status of our sign-ups today for people who want to be heard, we're going to take the bill slightly out of order, and we'll hear House Bill 2670 in public hearing first. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2670 creates a new personal income tax credit of $250 for firefighters who provide 100 hours of volunteer services, including training hours for a fire protection district or a fire department. It requires the chief of the fire protection district or the fire department to certify the credit and clarifies that a taxpayer may not claim both this credit and a credit for rural emergency medical technicians, which was created in the 2005 session.
Those are the firefighters outside.
Is that the firefighters out there? Thank you.
The credit applies to tax years 2008 through 2019.
Doesn't apply this year.
Correct. It would start for tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2008, and then has a sunset date of January 1, 2020.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Chris, perhaps you could just briefly let the folks at the dais know what happened last session in Senate Bill 31 relative to a $250 credit, where this is spawned from.
Representative Butler, last session in Senate Bill 31, there was a $250 credit created for rural EMTs. And those folks need to receive a certification from the Office of Rural Health, and there are certain criteria for qualifying for that credit. And the latest that credit began in 2006, so we haven't actually seen how it's flown through in the tax returns. Those returns are just now being filed. But the latest estimates were that had a revenue impact of about $200,000 a year.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to take people in order unless there's a good reason why I shouldn't. And first we have someone from more than 100 miles away, Steve Schneiderman, and also we have James, it looks like, Oder, and Scott Mullen. Would you gentlemen like to come forward? Welcome.
Thank you.
Please present your testimony.
My name is Steve Schneiderman, and I am the current president of the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association, and I'm also a volunteer firefighter in the city of Coos Bay and the rural district of Lakeside, Oregon. I'd like to introduce Jim Ader from Lebanon Fire District. And Jim is the past president of the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association. And on my right is Scott Mullins, and he is a career firefighter for State and Fire District, but also a volunteer firefighter for Lyons Fire District.
Bravo. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to be here today. I'd like to just tell you a little bit about the Volunteer Fire Service, if I may begin. I'm sure most of you are familiar with Rotary International and the Rotary Clubs and their motto of service above self. Well, volunteer firefighters really fall into the category of service above self. They give countless hours of their time. Most volunteer firefighters, besides having a regular job, it may not be a daytime job, 8-to-5 job, but they generally work a minimum 40-hour work week. Have families, have family time, then they have their volunteer fire service and maybe other organizations that they are a part of, might be school programs or other civic activities. Well, 25 years ago, tomorrow will mark my 25th year of being a volunteer firefighter. And when I first became a volunteer firefighter, you showed up at the department, filled out a little one-page application. They gave you a bunch of firefighting clothes, and they said, you're a firefighter. Well, the fire service has changed immensely since then. We used to have drill night. Once a week, all the firefighters would gather for 2-3 hours, and they'd have drill. We don't do that anymore. Now we have training night. Big difference. Training is structured. It's accredited. Firefighters get certifications for becoming a firefighter. There's different levels of firefighter. There's NFPA Firefighter 1, Firefighter 2, Fire Ground Leader, Fire Officer. And the higher up you want to go in those certifications, the more hours of training that's required. And it's quite the process. Just to make a volunteer fire, make any firefighter eligible to get on that piece of fire apparatus, the fire engine or the truck, whatever, requires 100 hours of training. And you have training on how to properly attach fire hose to a hydrant. You have training on how to properly carry and deploy a ladder. You have training on how to properly deploy a fire hose and which stream to use for what type of fire, you know, whether you want it to fog out wide or be narrow. You got to know what to do with your fire stream for effectively fighting the fire, but also effectively providing your own safety when you're inside a house. Because an example is you don't want to drop the thermal layer down on yourself or on your crew. So you deploy your fire line properly. Now, I mentioned the 100 hours. Now we have maintenance training. This is OSHA mandated. We have to put in X number of hours every 2 years to keep our certifications. And that backs up to where the volunteer firefighter has generally another job and a family and everything that goes along with that. Now, if you want to be your basic, you know, your firefighter one, that's great. You do the minimum training and you do your maintenance. But most of your volunteers, especially in communities that are served by all volunteers, there are some departments that are all career, some that are combination. They have career firefighters and they're supplemented by volunteers. And you have a lot of communities that are served 100% by volunteer firefighters. Well, you have your firefighter training. We talked about that. But if your department provides special services, if you have a technical rescue team, if you have swift water rescue, lake rescue, ocean rescue, high angle rescue over the cliffs, over the embankments, jaws of life, all those are additional levels of certification and require many more hours of training. If you're an all-volunteer department, if you have over 10 firefighters, by law, you have to have a safety committee. So you're going to put in extra time there besides your weekly training night and your fire calls and your rescue training night and your hazardous materials training night. So the hours keep adding up for the amount of volunteer time that these firefighters are giving to their communities. I just drew a blank for a second. Excuse me. So we've established the time commitment the volunteers put in and give to their communities, their counties, and their states. This tax credit is just a great way to give a little bit back to these volunteers that have given so much of their time as a volunteer. They've, you know, just we talk about the never-ending hours of training, and we haven't even talked about actual alarm response. So, you know, all these hours they put in just to be able to respond to those alarms, then they're leaving their family in the middle of the night for fire calls, rescue calls. They might have to leave their jobs for fire calls. A lot of employers allow their volunteers to leave the job to respond to an emergency. They're off the clock when they do that, but they're, you know, the employers realize that maybe, you know, what if it was their building that was burning? So they'd hope that the volunteers would be able to take time off from their works. We understand that they're not, you know, on the clock anymore, not getting paid by their employer when they're off fighting a fire. Volunteerism is down nationwide. It's down statewide. It's down communitywide. And this tax credit would be not only a great way to say thank you to the volunteers for all the hours they've put in, but it's also a good way to help recruit and retain more firefighters. I think that's kind of all I have to say on right now. I'd be glad to entertain any questions, or if you'd like to hear from Jim or Scott first.
I think what we'd like to do is hear from the other two, and then we may have questions for all of you.
Thank you.
And if you would, introduce yourself for the record and then give your testimony. Thank you.
Jim Ader with Oregon Volunteer Firefighters and Lebanon Fire District. One of the things, we know that this may not be the sole thing that will help us retain our members, but with some of the other programs, we think that this will just increase those packages. Some of our departments have a program called LOSAP, which is a length of service retirement type program. They get a little bit of money each year put in to that fund, depending on some requirements on it. But so with that and a few of the other things that we try to offer our people, we think that this will help increase our retention. Besides the fireside, you know, a lot of our people put in many hours taking their EMS to get certified. A basic EMS person has 140 hours just in class time just to get through that on top of what they put in on the regular week. So anything that we can, you know, that we can help to offset their expenses, because most of our members do not receive enough to reimburse their mileage. If they go to a fire, they ruin a shirt, pair of pants, those things, you know, they don't get enough to reimburse. So if we could help offset those costs with something like our tax credit, that would be a tremendous benefit for our membership.
Scott? I just had a brief statement. I'm sorry. Let me introduce myself. My name is Scott Mullen. I'm a director with the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association, and I volunteer with the Lyons Rural Fire District in Lyons, Oregon. I have a brief statement that I wanted to add on to what we've already talked about. You know, we've talked about the benefits that this would give to the volunteers of this state. What I'd like to talk about is I believe that this is a small financial commitment the state can make to the volunteers to show that we are being looked after. As President Snyderman indicated, our numbers are dropping, and they continue to drop, and we need to find different ways to keep our recruitment and our retention up. And if the numbers continue to fall and municipalities have to look to paid firefighters to cover public service and fire protection in their district, it's going to cost the state, counties, and cities a lot more money. So pushing forward this bill, I think, would help curb that trend. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do any of the three of you itemize your income tax deductions and use the out-of-pocket costs that you incur as volunteers as charitable deductions on your income tax returns?
I did early in my fire service career, but it was... The accountant really kind of said that's hard to do because you have to, in case of audit, you have to be able to prove all this. And you know, when the pager goes off in the middle of the night and you respond to a fire, there's only one thing on your mind at the time. And even for a few hours after the fire, depending on the circumstances, the last thing you think about is going home and writing down your mileage or if you ruined a shirt. And it really wasn't an effective way to do it. So
thank you. I appreciate that.
So I stopped doing that.
I appreciate that.
Representative Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, this could be directed to any of you. I guess more kind of for you right now, Steve, since you're the president. How many volunteer firemen do we have, firefighters do we have here in the state right now?
Approximately 7,000, I think the latest numbers, which compiled by the Office of the State Fire Marshal, was 7,666.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
What's the average total hours amongst all of them? Do you have a number like that they put in? That's training and response.
I'm going to ask Jim to help me out with this, but, you know, just the training hours to maintain mm-hmm. certification is around 100 hours mm-hmm. of training. The average volunteer department, their 1 week of regular fire training is 2 to 3 hours that particular night. But then if they have the other avenues, like I talked about, like technical rescue, that might be another night per month for 4 hours or so, and then other avenues of training. I probably put in, not including my time for the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association, I probably put in 20 hours a month. Okay. I'll let Jim kind of follow up on that, because I think he's done a little bit more of the research on those hours.
On the training side of it alone, most minimum I would say would be 20. Most a month, most of the time it's 30 to 40. A lot of the departments, and I can relate to Sweet Home and a few of the others, they have two nights a week that they train. One night is strictly EMS, which will take in half or more of their people, and that will include some of the rescue automotive extrications. The other night is on fireside. Usually those are 3 hours a night. Then on the response area, if it's Sweet Home, Tangent, and I can relate to the area I'm in, mm-hmm. some of those will have a lot higher responses than what some of the other departments do. Depends on if they're a combination department. The smaller departments are strictly all volunteer. Tangent, they have the freeway. Halsey Shed has the freeway, which increases their workload. Our area, we have in Lebanon, we have three stations. Our two substations run a higher call volume than what our in-town station does. In town, we average 150 to 300 or 150 to 175 calls a year for our volunteers at our main station. The substation out towards Sweet Home averages somewhere between 375 and 400. And the one in Lacombe is somewhere in the same number. So a lot of it depends on, you know, where you're at, but for those calls, emergency calls, can be anywhere from 5 minutes to 5 or 6 hours, just depending on what we have. A lot of it just depends on the area you're in and a lot of the traffic and population.
And if I could add to that, when your routine house fire, your routine motor vehicle accident, you know, we're talking motor vehicle accidents, 1 to 2 hours, house fires, 3 to 4 hours. Then when you get the catastrophes or disasters, you know, the hours are never ending, it seems like. 4 years ago, when the Coos Bay had the fire at Far West Truck that claimed the lives of three firefighters, every volunteer was there on that alarm for at least 20 hours. And you know, you get the big fires and the wildland fires that might be in your district that don't go to conflagration, but they're big. You'll be there 2-3 days.
I'd like to add just one more thing. We've talked about the tangibles, training, and the hours that it takes for us to train. But one of the things that I think is being overlooked is our community. The involvement we have with our community. Just about every volunteer department that I've ever known has some type of community event that they sponsor, or the community asks them to sponsor. I know at Staten we have quite a few. At Staten, Lyons, I have a couple of community events that the community comes to us and asks us to either sponsor or participate in. So those are even more volunteer hours that aren't really tangible.
Very good. You're reminding me of the Brownsville Firefighters Pancake Breakfast, that kind of thing. Yes, Representative Broom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any other reimbursement? You talked about the need to, if you burn up a shirt or you do miles, you need to do that as a tax credit. And I realize that some of the volunteer fire districts may be different. They may not be uniform. But is there any reimbursement now at all? I mean, and let me be, and one narrow part of that, what about insurance? I assume that you are covered for health insurance, at least on the job safety, you know, accident insurance. Is that true or no? Okay, you're covered for that. Is there anything else that you are covered for or that you receive any sort of reimbursement or compensation for, per diem, anything?
Every department is different when it comes to that. Departments that have the revenue available, they will budget in their city budget or their district budget for some type of reimbursement for their volunteers. I mean, minimal. Last month, my reimbursement was $20 for a full month of stuff. You know, that's to cover mileage or shirts or stuff. So it's very low. But on alarms and training, we are covered by workman's comp, whether it's say for city county insurance or whatever fund. Yeah, I think mandated by law that all firefighters have that coverage.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. A little bit different tack. You mentioned it was compelling testimony. You mentioned the decline in volunteerism, and I guess my only concern about this bill is that if I'm somebody that's considering risking life or limb, a $250 tax credit that I may be able to file for 12 or 14 months later doesn't seem to me like it's enough. And I guess I'm concerned that this shouldn't be looked at as some sort of a panacea. I don't think $250 is enough to affect positively the volunteerism drop-off. I don't know if, and I'm sure you're not using this as the only, I mean, have you looked at the broader reasons why you're losing volunteers?
There's been studies on decline of volunteerism, and the number one reason is the lack of time. And once again, it takes it back. You know, I'm a small business owner, so I'm putting in more than a 40-hour work week at work, and then all the other requirements. You know, I have a father of four kids. I got school events. Kids getting ready to graduate. Family time, and we encourage our firefighters to never forget their families and family time. It's just harder and harder with all the hours that are mandated to be a firefighter. You know, there's just, you know, sometimes they weigh it out, and a lot of people are finding that that's not worth it. But, you know, now if we can give back a little bit more, then they weigh it out, then it tips the scale a little bit. We know that the $250 isn't going to make or break the departments on their recruitment and retention, but it is a piece of the equation that's going to help.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of comments, if you'll indulge me.
Please.
Gentlemen, in these notes that in my district, the fire volunteer fire district in Kaiser said that there are 342 fire departments, over 12,000 firefighters in the state, and of these 8,000 are volunteers, 7,666. It's, you know, round numbers. I wasn't aware until during the interim that among all the other things that you need to train for, critical, important things like saving lives and saving property and saving yourselves, that you are all 12,000, volunteer or not, under the same statutory ethics requirements as all of us. And I don't know if you get around to training your folks in that, but it is another thing that can catch you up. I don't think $250 worth of personal income tax credit is going to pay any of you for the time and effort and training and things that you have to know and the things that you're responsible for. I think more than anything else, this is like a little thank you. We notice, we appreciate, and by way of, if I could add one more thing, Mr. Chair, a personal note, my family since 1922 has had a small frame cabin in Pacific City, Oregon. It has been saved from destruction three times since 1922 by all volunteer fire departments. Where would we be without them? So I know $250 isn't going to be a huge recruiting tool, but if it says thank you, I think it's a real good idea. Thank you.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just a comment. Spent 29 years in law enforcement and been around the state a few different locations, but greatly appreciate what you do. And, I mean, I can think of numerous times that I was just glad to see you there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I believe it. Others?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I'm sorry that I missed part of the hearing, and I do want to express my appreciation to the volunteers, and that's why I brought forward what got us here from the other volunteers. But it's so important to take good care of your volunteers. You know, we've got a set of volunteer firefighters over on the Idaho side and some small towns up in Valley County and Council and those places up there. Their motto is that they have never lost a concrete foundation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. And they have to grin anyway. Thank you. Anything else for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. I know that at least one of you came from a long way off. We appreciate your attendance today and the testimony that you've given us.
We appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you.
Thank you
very
thank
much.
You.
And we have some members of the House who would like to testify on this bill. And what, would you please come forward?
Since she's got notes, I'll go first because I have to remember. And I got to get back to my committee. But for the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32. And obviously, I'm in support of this bill. I sponsored the bill at the request of a constituent in Cannon Beach, Mike Johnson. And for Representative Bruin's comment about it not being enough, we started out the bill at $1,000. And there were three or four different permutations of the bill, and we all got together and decided to go with it. And it is merely a small thank you. For those of you who do know me, you know I am a volunteer firefighter and emergency tech first responder at this point. And I serve for a small fire district on Highway 26. We do about 9 miles on Highway 26 and a series of small districts, all volunteer, carry you from, and when you travel down to the north coast on Highway 26, you are going through a series of small districts that all work together. We all have mutual aid agreements for bigger things, and sometimes, as the guys who are just up here could attest to, in towns like or areas where I come from, you don't know how many people will respond. So it's incumbent on you guys to take real good care of us, because if you have a crash on a high speed crash on a highway, it's usually a bad one. And as he said, we're an hour or two on that scene, depending on what you find. And then there's cleanup, then there's all this, and this is just a call, and you can have on a, especially in my area with a high tourism and impact, if you will, in the summertime especially, but it's becoming a lot more year-round with a lot of the fishing industry and clamming, whatever else you do at the beach, just going down to watch the waves or run your dogs. But it's a lot of time spent training, and the more the state requires of us to train and find a common level of training so that you do get good service from everybody across the state, you might have two people show up at a scene, and then you have to call for help, and you don't know what you're going to need if you have two-car MVA with six patients and you have two people show up, and we're dealing with how many people go on a rig. I mean, well, that's a whole different area. But anyway, there are a lot of things that can happen, and that's just, you want someone to be trained who shows up to that. And so most departments, ours, I can only speak for ours, and in my area, usually once a week for training, and then an additional once a week for EMS training. And then there's the weekend, the whole weekend for equipment training. You have to be certified by the state to drive equipment. And then there's a whole series of volunteer, all volunteer, again, wildland fire that we have to deal with. And in my district, we handle many square miles of forest land, so we do all the logging accidents too. So, and we also, that means we also have to train with the Life Flight and everybody else who handles these big events. So it's a very small thank you. It's a very small token of thanks, and it nowhere comes near reimbursing in actual expenses out. So I hope you will support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Boone. I'm Representative Patty Smith. I represent East Multnomah, East Clackamas, and Hood River County. And I have multiple fire districts, some all volunteer, some combination, some paid, great firefighters that are, they spend a lot of time. So I got to just tell you, I'm here to support this bill. Senator Metzger and I sponsored a bill that's been incorporated into this bill. Mainly because firefighters were calling us, asking us why they didn't qualify for the credit, because they live too close. But it's a huge metro area, close to a metro area with lots of rescue and lots of volunteer requirements. Corbett itself has a 50 all-volunteer fire service. We're so grateful to have them. They just do a wonderful job, and I don't think there's any way to repay them. The $250 tax credit is just a great big thank you. So I'm here to support this bill, and I hope you'll move it along, and be glad to answer your questions.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is probably directed to Debbie. Debbie, we do have the $250 credit for the rural EMTs and your first responder that provide 20% or more of their total time in being EMTs. Is there a possibility that a person, and I'm sorry, I don't know about the training, the cross training, mm-hmm. for fire training and EMT, is there a possibility that this could open up an opportunity for folks to have a $250 rural EMT credit as well as a $250 volunteer 100-hour volunteer fire protection district credit?
You know, I'm not sure. I have to be honest with you, because some of the districts do. Like in my district, you're both. You're EMS and fire, and sometimes when you respond to a fire, it is both, but there's not two separate entities of the district personnel. And I know when we started out this bill, too, some of the bills were just fire, some were fire and EMS, and they ended up, I was absent during the time for my medical leave when they had the work group meet, and they decided to, and I totally agreed with it, to separate it out, too, between EMS and fire. So I will get that answer for you if you need it.
I think it may be answered by staff and the chair.
Chris? Representative Butler, it is not allowed in Section 7, or Section 1.
Some of that.
Section 2, Sub 7, Line 6 and 7, clarifies that the credit cannot be claimed under both circumstances.
Okay, I thought it was.
Thank you. Either one or the other, but not both.
Yeah. Chris, right? I have correct. To say, you look so much like my son. This is just strange looking at you. Sorry, if I stare at you, that's why. Why is Peter here?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I knew it was criminal, in man. There. I know. Are you talking about double dipping? Sort of, yeah. No, we fixed that, so.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you. Other questions, comments for the, yes.
Yeah, it's a quick question, and first of all, thank you to both representatives for working so hard on this. It's obviously a wonderful thing to be looking at. And I guess it just raised one question. We talked about the firefighters and the emergency medical providers. Were volunteer police ever considered, and you weren't part of the work sessions, but do we have anything? I mean, I realize it's not as big as the volunteer fire.
There were, I think people started talking about it, and we wanted to keep it fairly clean and separate.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
We appreciate
you.
Your testimony
well,
very much.
I appreciate the committee looking at this and all your comments. They're greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 2670?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Butler.
Final question to staff. Any way of calculating what this could be? We've been told that there between 7,000, 7,600 total firefighters, whether they are rural firefighters or whether they get the 100 hours, any way that we would know, and of course they have to be certified by their local rural chief.
Representative Butler, I would follow up with the Office of the State Fire Marshal to find out. It looks like they have some pretty good information on the number of these volunteers, and so the question would be how much of the overlap between the two. So I could follow up on that and get a sense for what it would cost.
Well, that would certainly be helpful, I would think, in order to be able to get an idea of the dollar amount that we may be talking about. My attention was drawn back to the question I originally asked. Do you file income tax returns and take this as a deduction? Well, the reason that it's not a deduction is because so many times the onerous requirements to keep track of everything for federal purposes gets lost in the process. Whereas if it was a $250 state tax credit, they still would be out of pocket a lot of money, but it would be most helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, if I might, Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association and the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. In response to Representative Butler's question, it is somewhat difficult to come up with an answer. I've got a representative of the Fire Marshal's Office up here with me. You know, the EMT tax credit that you helped us with last session, we just haven't seen enough trending from that to know what the impact of that is going to be. From the volunteer side, from the volunteer firefighter side, there's going to be an awful lot of them that do qualify under the 100 hours, but the specific number, as you heard testimony, those districts and departments that have portions of interstate highways and other more active areas where there's more multi-vehicle accidents, that sort of thing, they're going to have more response time. The very rural ones that are out in more remote areas of the state won't have as many, but of course there's fewer volunteers there. So there's a bunch of dynamics that we're really not sure how many people we're really going to be talking about. Probably not the whole 8,000 rounding, but it's going to be a pretty sizable number would be my guess. And I'd like to let also the Fire Marshal's Office respond to that, if I might, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
And my name is Donna Dish, and I am with the Office of State Fire Marshal, as Ken said. We would suggest that for a more accurate number, you may want to look at DPSST certifications. That they are the ones who do the certifying of our firefighters. They do much of the training. We work very, very closely with them, and that's a cooperative relationship that we have. While we do have fire departments report to us how many firefighters they have, I would suggest for the purposes of your bill that it would be probably best to look to DPSST.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative, if I can, these folks are, in fact, then DPSST trained and certified.
Well, it depends on where they are in a system and what they're working for within their fire department. But yes, they are.
Thank you. That would certainly be an easier way to keep track of it, too.
Yes.
Assist in keeping track of it.
That might be a subject for discussion about the amendments of the bill, perhaps, as a possibility. Do we have any idea what the number is of volunteer firefighters who are certified?
The numbers that you've been hearing today are from our data.
Thank you. We'll get you back on the record, and then you can answer that question.
James Ader. Roughly, I would say at this point we have 90 to 95% of our members are certified. Without directly talking with DPST, I can't give you exact, but most of when we train our people through our regional training associations, they are being trained to meet NFPA certifications for Firefighter 1, and then it proceeds in-house to Firefighter 2. So with that, you know, 90% of our people, I would say for sure, it's mainly because it's the industry standard, and unless they're way out and they do not provide interior structural firefighting, most of them do have their people at least a Firefighter 1.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Did you want to add something?
I'd like to add something. For a different bill, we put together the kind of training that's done at DPSST, and for this committee, I would be happy to provide that list.
I think that might be helpful.
Okay.
And if you could provide it to the revenue office, they would be sure to distribute it. Just make sure there's reference to the bill number.
I will do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, perhaps Donna could help work with the representatives so that if there was an amendment that we need, and Ken, I think that's the direction it sounds like we're going, so that we can isolate and identify to better help our legislative revenue office identify how many folks could qualify here.
Be happy to.
Thank you.
That might be helpful. Thank you. And I think we have another repeat.
Thank you.
I just wanted to add one thing to the testimony, if I may, on the part we were just talking about. I remember from the work session, and I maybe staff can help clarify in the actual bill, but I believe that we had stated, besides 100 hours of service, that you also did maintain the Firefighter 1 certification. And that we put in there because there are departments that are not certified firefighters. They're volunteer firefighters, but not certified firefighters for some reason. And we thought it would be better for all concerned and use this as a win-win, a little give back to the departments, but also to encourage all firefighters to become certified so they can offer the best possible service to their communities.
Thank you. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
That's very helpful. Is there anyone else? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2670, and we'll go on to the hearing on House Bill 3243.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3243 creates a new personal income tax credit for individuals who graduate from an Oregon high school or receive a GED on or after July 1, 2007. And the amount of the credit, they graduate from Oregon high school or receive a GED and then receive a degree or certificate from an eligible post-secondary Oregon institution. The amount of the credit depends on if we're talking about a community college or a four-year school. If the student goes to a community college and receives a degree within 3 years, they get a $125 credit for 2 years. If they go to an Oregon four-year college or university and obtain a degree within 5 years, they get a $250 credit for 4 years. If they go to 2 years, if they get a community college degree within 3 years and then finish up at a four-year institution, they can get 2 years of a $125 credit and 2 years of a $250 credit. The taxpayer can't use both the community college credit and the four-year credit in the same year, and the bill requires the taxpayer to pay for and receive the instruction leading to the degree, and the bill applies to amounts paid on or after January 1, 2009 and has a sunset date of January 1, 2018. And the credit is non-refundable and may not be carried forward.
Thank you. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Tobias Reed, state representative from District 27 in Beaverton. It's a new perspective for me sitting here looking at all of you, and I say you all look great. Thanks to Representative Berger, Representative Bruin, Representative Gelser on our committee for being co-sponsors. Happy to introduce to you what we're calling the Earned Education Tax Credit. It's a fairly simple concept, as you heard, to expand a tax credit to graduates of Oregon high schools who graduate from an Oregon institution of higher education. So I think it's clear that if we want the Oregon, if we're going to get the Oregon we want, that is, we're dependent on everybody's ability to live up to his or her full potential. And I think a big part of that is helping people think big. I think a prerequisite of that is feeling like education beyond high school is accessible. There's lots of evidence about the value of that, both in terms of earnings, and I think maybe more importantly, in terms of anecdotally, I think I can certainly think of lots of examples, and I imagine you can too, of people who go off to college to only to conceive an entirely new ambition. I think that transformational aspect is really important, and it's exciting to think about what's possible if more Oregonians had that chance. I think more Oregonians in college means a deeper, richer, more diverse talent pool to overcome our obstacles and build the community we want. So our bill is pretty simple. Offers a tax credit to two specific populations. It's graduates of Oregon high schools, but it offers it only after a student graduates. And what I meant by two specific populations is two different kinds of students after they've graduated. For one category, I think it's clear that they're going to go to college. The only question is whether they'll go in Oregon or somewhere else. The other category is someone who doesn't think that college is accessible at all. I think it's just not a possibility. For a little bit of reference, I handed out a graphic sort of representation of some data we've been able to gather from various sources that gives you sort of a picture of what happens to people after they graduate from college. So that's kind of a stark reality about who is going to college, where they're going, and who is and is not finishing. I think it's important for us to be able to say to those two populations, particularly, that college is important and we want to help. We want to be inclusive in this, so community colleges and four-year institutions are included, private colleges are included, and as I said, even the certificate programs at community colleges. The only restriction we're making is that students graduate in a reasonable period of time. We're also trying to make it simple. This is a marketing tool in some respects to be able to say at that critical time when people are making decisions that we want to help. So we're making it simple. We're saying if you go and you finish, you will have a tax credit of $125 per year of community college, $250 per year of a four-year institution. We want to make this easy for students to be able to administer and handle. We're not making any distinctions based on scholarships or those sorts of things. We're making the simple assumption that if they were able to graduate, they must have made some significant contributions to doing so. And I think there's a lot of argument to be made about the benefit to the state as more people graduate and stay in state and hopefully earn more money and pay more taxes. So that's basically the concept of the bill. We've worked it through the Education Committee, and thanks to those committee members who helped us refine it a bit. You have an amendment, an engrossed version, which has a sunset, reflects, I think, some of the challenges in our current environment about getting through college or community college in a reasonable amount of time, acknowledges some of those difficulties. And while we don't have a revenue statement at the moment, we've been working with Chris Allenack, who's helped a lot. In terms of scope, I can tell you that we're talking about a couple of million dollars a year, not $20 million. And I'll just close with one quote. I don't think it's probably possible to overstate how important higher education is, but in trying to sum it up, I look to one of our founders, both of our country and of the University of Virginia. Jefferson was talking about the University of Virginia at one point and said, in establishing an institution for them, talking about the future, we secure it to all future generations, that in fulfilling this duty we bring home to our own bosoms the sweet consolation of seeing our sons, and I might add our daughters, rising under a luminous tuition to destinies of high promise. I'm excited about the possibility of this bill, what it might do for folks who are thinking about whether they can go to college and where they might do so, and I'd appreciate your support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Butler.
Just a couple of questions for clarification, Representative. Thank you very much for bringing us forward. I think the concept of rewarding college education is certainly a laudable program. They have to be the full-time students the entire time. Is that your concept?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Butler, not necessarily. What we've said is that they need to graduate within that period of time. I think we've said 3 years for community college and 5 years for an undergraduate degree. So if they're resourceful enough to be able to do it in some other fashion within that period of time, that's okay. What we're trying to target is that they're finishing, earning a degree.
Okay. I just want to follow up on that, if I may, because certainly a student could go 12 months of the year and not be full-time for part of that time, but then could finish up
Would they be required to be an Oregon resident the entire time that they're in their university studies?
They would, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Butler, I don't think so. There are provisions elsewhere, and I'm not an expert on this. I'd probably defer to you. I think it's 316.117 that deals with the division of income and tax treatment for those who become residents or become non-residents, and that would apply just as it does elsewhere, I think.
Okay, and one final question. Let's assume that a student, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Let's assume the student was graduated from an Oregon high school, was anxious to go on and become a full-time college student, and in fact did a first year at an Oregon university system, and then had an opportunity to do something else for 2 years in a foreign country to learn a foreign language, to learn a foreign culture, and then might come back. His or her education would take a total of 6 years. Would they then not qualify?
Under the current language, Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Butler, I think that's correct. They would not qualify. We've given, if I'm remembering correctly, 5 years for an undergraduate institution. I certainly wouldn't suggest that that's not a laudable program or pursuit, but in this case we're trying to really motivate finishing, and I think that would, unfortunately, in the current version, not be eligible. However, it's also important to note that I view this as an experiment, and if it does indeed help to increase the number of graduates, we might very well look at expanding it down the road.
You know to whom I am speaking, I assume.
I suspect so.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. Other questions? Representative, just to make certain that I understand, this is a tax credit that a taxpayer would take after they've graduated. So we've gone through this 3-year period with an AA degree at the end, or the 5-year period with a bachelor's degree at the end, and after that, you'd get a tax credit for 2 years.
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely right. The key here is to hang that carrot there for folks to graduate. It's important that people go to college, certainly, but it's also important, and that's hopefully the statement we make if we enact this, to say that we want you not only to go, we want you to finish.
Yes. And then, of course, you have to live in Oregon, or at least nearby, in order to incur Oregon income taxes on which you would get the credit.
Absolutely right,
Thank
Mr.
You.
Chair.
Thank you. Others? Yes, Representative Rosenbaum.
Mr. Chair, and I think that the Oregon Progress Board's report yesterday clearly highlighted the abysmal record that we have of college graduation among our residents, so I really applaud you for taking this on. My question, though, is it doesn't appear there's any kind of means testing in this, so would this seems like it might end up benefiting some higher income people too. Can you address that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, that's true. We're not trying to target it, but simply say anyone. And again, I think that goes back to my earlier statement about two different populations of students for whom this could be particularly relevant. The folks who are clearly going to go to college, their decision might be between whether they go to the University of Oregon or the University of Washington, or pick some other pair of colleges. And then also there's the folks for whom college may not seem accessible. And I think it's important that we're trying to keep the best Oregonians here, regardless of their economic status. I think there's real benefit if we can say at the beginning, we want you to go to college, and we want you to do it in Oregon. And that's a message I think that's relevant for everyone who's graduating from high school.
That raises another question for me. Is there a restriction on here on out-of-state colleges?
Yes, there is. It's Mr. Chair, it's only for Oregon institutions.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Bruce.
Also raises another question. I'm a co-sponsor of this bill, and I applaud. Thank you, Representative Reed. I think this is an excellent path to go down. What about the parents who are paying for the college degree rather than the student?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, we're not, again, we're trying to make it very simple, and we're assuming there might be examples where this is not the case, but in the course of earning a college degree, the student probably makes some contribution, whether it's to tuition or to room and board or to books over the course of that. We're assuming that they made some contribution, and again, the incentive is to get finished. And it comes at it also, I think, potentially has a real benefit in that critical time after a student has graduated as they're trying to establish themselves, probably dealing with some student loans and those other mm-hmm. sorts of challenges of getting established right after graduation.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Michael, was that, Representative Reed, was that issue vetted at all in the prior committee? I hear what you're saying. I also understand, you know, your desire, and I think it's a good desire to keep it as simple as possible. Let's not muddy the waters at all. But I'm curious if that question was vetted in that. I hear what you're saying, that most students probably contribute in one form or another, even if parents are picking up the tuition. But I guess the point is we're trying to encourage people to go to college, and if the parents are a significant portion of making that happen, maybe the parents, I guess I'm asking, was that ever brought in as part of the discussion and specifically ruled out, saying, hey, we're not going to look at necessarily the payer, we're only going to look at the student?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, one of the challenges in doing that, I think, is figuring out how the incentive can go with the person who controls what happens in school. So if the credit applied to parents, I think back to my own graduate education, and one of the messages our accounting professor always said was that you get what you measure. So I was hoping to tie this to the person who really gets to control whether they're going to graduate or not. So it needs to, in my mind, it needs to happen after graduation. And at that point, I'd rather it go to the student who gets to determine whether they're going to class and doing the things they need to graduate.
One last thought. There's a way to sort this out, and it's leaving it the way it is, but just having the parent make sure that come Christmas time after the graduation, the present's a little nicer than it otherwise would have been. So.
Good point, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Reed. My name is on here, too, because... like you, I'm concerned about folks leaving our state or not taking advantage of educational opportunities that are nearby. One of the statistics that I wish you had in here, maybe you have it, is how many, and this is in a way related to Representative Bruin's comment, how many Oregon graduates, either they or their parents have loans at the end of the 5 years or the 3 years. And I would venture it's a pretty big number. Somebody's paying off that. Nobody goes through, or a very low percentage, I would guess, go through just paying the dime.
I suspect you're right, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger. I don't have the specific numbers, but in my experience at Willamette, there were significant numbers of people. Most people had some form of loans, and for most it was a significant factor. And I know that's true. Some of my friends who are at other places in the state of Oregon, it is a big problem. And again, I don't mean for this bill to make any commentary on the adequacy of our other efforts to fund higher education and make it accessible to people. This is, I hope, just a small piece of a bigger bigger package, I hope.
Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you, Representative Reed. I appreciate very much your bringing this bill and the excellent presentation. Is there anyone else today who would like to be heard on House Bill 3243? Yes, please. The department would like to be heard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, in listening to the testimony about the intent that these be Oregon institutions, I think there might need to be a little bit of clarification around the definition of community college. And it's perhaps just a little bit of tweaking with the words, but as it is in the bill, it appears that it could include community colleges that are out of state. There is a definition of community colleges in 348180, which is referenced in the bill, but it is only for purposes of defining the eligible post-secondary institution. So I'd be more than happy to work with staff and perhaps legislative council to see whether this really does restrict it to Oregon communities, community colleges.
Thank you, but we understand that's the intent of the bill. Yes. Thank you. I appreciate having that pointed out to us. I would note also that this bill and the previous one that we heard, if they were to go any further, would require that we have a purpose statement and a way of measuring whether that purpose was met or not. And with that, we'll close the public hearing and we'll open a work session on House Bill 3048. And I think that's Paul, isn't it? Colleagues, while he's coming up, remember this is the bill that changes the measuring year for kicker refunds to corporations. Have I got it right?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We have a dash 2 amendment for you that incorporates the discussion you had when you had a hearing on 3048. As you recall, the whole purpose of the bill is the two words on page 2 of the amendment. The amendment replaces the bill. Line 11 would go through and refer to the prior year for calculating the 2% surplus corporate kicker. As you recall, the problem that we have is that in August, when the state economist is calculating the kicker, he takes the total amount of surplus revenue, divides it by the estimated total liability for corporations in that current year, a number that he doesn't know. And in fact, I was up at the Revenue Forecast Advisors meeting on Friday, and for the $101 million surplus we had following last biennium, we're now estimating that it's going to cost over $150 million for that credit. Because the liability that was used to calculate that percentage, a 35.9% credit, was way too low. And that, of course, is why you have another kicker this time, because corporate revenue has come in much stronger than expected. So this bill is trying to deal with that by referring the calculation to the prior year. If you look on page 3, you see the language there. Again, it makes it clear. The deleted language says that for a taxable beginning in the calendar year in which the excess is determined, if you look at lines 7 and 8, it's for tax years beginning in the calendar year immediately preceding the calendar year in which the excess is determined. So, for example, if we were to have a corporate kicker paid at the end of this biennium, it would be, instead of the 2007 tax year, it would be the 2006 tax year, which would bring it into the same calculation as the personal refund, which is also based on the prior year. There's also some additional language in there that was asked for by Department of Revenue in terms of, for example, lines 15 through 17, determined based on tax liability as shown on the return or as corrected by Department of Revenue. The issue that you talked about with Deborah was when you remove the credit calculation from the year in which you're filing for, you raise the possibility that the kicker credit may exceed your total liability. So, in effect, you can zero out somebody's liability and you don't get to use the entire credit. So, if you look at the new language starting on line 22 on page 3 there of the amendment, it refers to a situation in which the tax liability is reduced to zero, and what it does is allow, unlike current law, it allows corporations to carry forward that 2% surplus kicker credit into succeeding years until all remaining amounts of unused credits are offset against tax liability. So in other words, they can carry that credit forward.
I have a question about the mechanics of that, Mr. Chair. Oregon doesn't have any recapturable credits, does it, Paul?
Don't believe so.
Okay, so we wouldn't be using it up against a recapturable credit. Thank you very much.
The other thing I would point out, because you're going to get a bill that would change this, is if you look on page 5. Of the amendment says that the taxpayer's tax liability is the amount shown in the return or adjusted by the Department of Revenue and is determined after the allowance of any other credit. Now, that's current law, is that when you take your kicker credit, you have to account for all other credits beforehand. And I'm sure you've been heard part of the discussion that's been going on in the Senate with Senate Bill 819 that would change that after to before. And that's really been in response to concern, particularly from Department of Energy, about marketable credits and being used for, in particular, the BETC and RETC credits that you voted in this committee to expand. And as a response to that, Senate Bill 819 has changed that. So there, if you do approve this bill, and you'll be getting Senate Revenue Committee has approved Senate Bill 819, that's headed for the Senate floor, we'll have to do some reconciliation if both these bills end up getting through the process.
Mm-hmm. Now, the way it would work with this bill, I think, is that if a person used their BETC and RETC credits and didn't have very much left, like the corporation did, then they would carry forward this credit into future years. According to this bill,
yes, this bill would not change that calculation. You would go through and use your BETC and RETC credits first, and you may end up having a very limited amount of liability in which to apply your kicker.
Mr. Chair, you're using BETC and RETC.
That could be any credit, of course.
But this is corporate, so the RETC wouldn't necessarily...
You're correct. I'm sorry.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I was looking to make sure that we're not talking about 316 here.
No. Okay. 819 would apply to both personal
and corporate. Thank you very much. I'm sorry.
Yes, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, when you were with the amendment, did you do any calculation, some historical calculation, to see what dollar difference would have been with the corporate kicker, and any past periods where the corporate kicker has been paid out? I mean, is
Representative Brown, I haven't. The difference would be, you mean in terms of past errors we've made?
No, in terms of actual dollar differences that would have happened had this been in place versus what historically happened.
I have not done that, Representative Brown. We did, as you recall, we did look at historically what's gone out as credits versus what was calculated to go out, and there was a sizable difference of over $50 million in both 95 and 97 kicker years, and the signs were different. So one was positive, one was negative.
Mm-hmm.
So this can go either way. But I haven't gone back and applied that percentage to the liability in the prior year.
Thank you.
One of the things, are there others? One of the things I'd like to ask about is the sequence of the way this works. I think it's in on page 3. The way in which this is calculated, corporate income for tax years beginning in the calendar year, immediately preceding the calendar year in which the excess is determined. So if we were to do a kicker this year, and of course we're not going to because of the rainy day bill, but unless the receipts come in a lot higher than we expect. But if this were a kicker year, then the measuring year would be 2007. And therefore we would go back to the year before and we'd say that tax years that began in 2006 would be the measure for the refund. Now, if a tax year began in September of 06, we wouldn't get a return until December of, or maybe even January, I forget exactly what the dates are, of 08, December of 07, January 08. If the corporate year begins in July, we would get one in September, I suppose.
Huh? Yeah, that's the soonest
we'd get one. So you're still working from an estimate, aren't you? It's just a better estimate because you've received most of the money over the year.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Again, at the meeting I was at last Friday, Michael Kennedy went through the dates, and by August of this year, we should have a pretty, we'll finally have really completely nailed down 2005 and have a very good estimate of 2006.
So if I can sort of follow the line of thinking, what you're really talking about here is reducing the potential error in the estimate for the amount that's to be refunded.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. What we're trying to do with the bill is to bring in line the percentage credit so that it's going to be a lot closer to the actual amount of excess collections. And because that's the mechanism we do that. If we get that percentage wrong, then you end up giving back too little or too much in credits, and we won't know that till 2.5 years later.
Yes, and then one final comment, if I may, is that for most corporations, the year that we're talking about using as the measuring year is either entirely or almost entirely within the biennium for which the kicker is being calculated. I suppose if you had a very late 06 beginning after July 1st.
November.
After July 1st, the beginning for the tax year after July 1st, then you could extend into the 07-09 biennium. But as it is now, under the current law, if I understand it correctly, many corporations have none of their tax year in the biennium for which they're getting the refund.
Mr. Chair, that's right, for the year in which we're calculating.
What that we're calculating it from.
That's correct.
All right. Okay. Representative Butler.
Thank you.
It just seems fairer to me. That's the reason I raised that.
I thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and please bear with me while I ask the question. Paul, can you take us through the mechanics of how a corporation would, number one, calculate the credit which it'll be taking in the subsequent year, and then the notification requirement and those kinds of things? We're not issuing a voucher, which is something we've talked about previously, an escheatable voucher, but maybe just help me with the mechanics. I'm anxious about that.
I'll walk through this, and we may want to call Deborah up at some point to talk about how the department would administer it. By going to the calculation of 2006, you're still going to apply the credit when you file your 2007 return. So you're still, you're in effect, you're filing a return for the 2007 tax year, but you're getting a credit based on 2006, based on that that percentage in that year.
And the percentage would show up on page 2 of the 11 or of the form 20 then at that particular point, assuming.
Yeah, so I don't think there'd be any difference in the way the department operates on that now. What the department does is in August, they will put on their website what that kicker credit percentage is. So they'll do that. Again, we'll assume we've got an 07 credit. In August of 07, as soon as they get certification what the percentage is, they'll put it on their website. So corporations will know what their kicker credit will be. But it's just that'll be based on the prior year, so they'll have to notify them it's based on 2006.
So if I can, Mr. Chair,
yes, please.
Let's just make an assumption that it's 20% and that my 2006 return having been, and I'm calendar year, 2006 return having been filed, and I have a total tax, ordinary tax, 318 tax, or 317 tax for Oregon of $100,000. And the website comes up that says everybody, all corporations are going to be entitled to a 20%. So now I know by going to the website that I'm going to be entitled to a $20,000 credit on my 2007. The mechanics then are that I have to go to the website first. Do I see on the face of the instructions, or I guess most accountants in state might know, but I'm concerned about those that are in New York that are filing Oregon tax returns.
You will be notified of that percent on your return, but you know, I think the other issue is that it will be that the change will be that will be based on your 2006 liability. So in 2006, you may have $100,000 in profits and eligible for a $20,000 credit.
Right.
But let's say in 2007, you had zero net income.
Right.
So
right.
That's what this other
and it does. I understand that it does in fact carry it over. I'm still anxious to just find out how the corporation who is getting ready to file. And again, I've got a New Jersey tax preparer that has some sales out in Oregon and owes $100,000 in 2006 and may not have as much sales in 2007, may not even be required to file in 2007. How do they know that they've got a $20,000 credit out there that they could use in 2007 had they filed, or in 2008 or subsequent years in a carryover?
How would that's a good question for Deborah.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry to
relate to that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that is a very good question for everyone, I think. As it works now, as you know, if there were a corporate kicker, the taxpayers, in filing their 2007 return, would calculate tax, claim credits, and that net amount would be the base for whatever kicker is determined. Let's assume it is 20%. And the only difference, as Mr. Warner said, is instead of using the tax amount that's on the 2007 return, they will go to the tax amount on the 2006 return. And our worksheet, our instructions will have that information. The percentage will be on the form, but we will direct them to the line on their 2006 return that they need to reference in calculating the credit on the 2007 return. And then if that exceeds the net tax after credits on 2007, they will carry the excess over to 2008. If there's still an excess, they can carry it forward to 2009. They can carry it forward indefinitely until it's fully exhausted. And taxpayers will need to educate themselves about this difference. And if for some reason they don't have to file a 2007 return but did file a 2006 return, when they do find out about it, they would be able to amend the 2007 and claim that excess credit and carry it forward to 2008. Those that never have a liability after 2006 will have that credit go on indefinitely until you decide to change the law and say it goes away or send them a check or something, but it will be an indefinite carry forward under this.
Yes, Representative. And Deborah, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Would you anticipate that the department and receiving the 2007 return on the circumstances which we had just talked about, that they had a $100,000 liability 2006, that it was a 20% calculation. When the return is filed for 2007 and they owe $100,000 total in 2007 before any credits, and they take no credits against it, do you anticipate that the department would then monitor and say, wait a minute, you are entitled to a credit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, we do typically make corrections when corporations do not claim the kicker that they're entitled to on the returns that they're filing now.
Okay.
This will be a little bit more complicated because we would need to go back and verify that they actually had some tax liability in 2006. So we do need to make sure that in our processes we inform taxpayers they're entitled to that credit.
Two comments, if I may. Mr. Chairman, I think this will get to the kernel of it. Number one, this does take care of the concern that I've always had of what about that new corporation that comes to Oregon and has a $1 million profit in 2007 and didn't have a 2006 return and yet still would be qualifying for on a page two of a 20% credit when they didn't have a prior year tax return. This takes care of that because they don't have a prior year tax return. They would not have earned any of the credit for the carryover.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, that's correct. If the corporation had no liability in 2006, they received no kicker credit on the 2007 tax return.
Second issue, if I may, Mr. Chair, and that is this would be abundantly fair to those folks who did have a business energy tax credit or other kinds of tax credits that they would be entitled to, which basically could get eaten up in the current fashion that we do this. They could get eaten up, and then they would take the credit against the net tax. What we're actually doing is offering them the tax rebate based upon the actual amount, the true amount of the corporate kicker that was calculated by the economist in August of the prior year. Am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, I believe so. I hope so. I defer to your economist on that question, if I may.
Representative, I think your point is that it would more closely match the amount of excess revenue, in effect. I mean, it would be, and, you know, if you take that midpoint calendar year, that's going to be, you know, the calendar year that most reflects what happened in that biennium, the economic activity that occurred and the earnings that occurred.
Again, I say, Mr. Chair, it appears that it overcomes this problem of the new guys coming to town and receiving a credit for a kicker for a year that they didn't do business in Oregon. And the second thing is, it does offer them then the opportunity. And when we're talking about business energy tax credits, we're talking about tax credits that they really have an opt-in or opt-out opportunity to jump into, and they look at it and say, this is not the year that I'm going to want to do a business energy tax credit. I'm going to defer that because I've got my kicker coming, and I don't want to disturb my kicker. So that really more fairly approximates the amount of the kicker that they were entitled to.
If I may add to, I think that the issue that you raised, Vice Chair Butler, really came up when we changed the apportionment formula, because you did have really a change in the composition of the tax. And so applying the credit to liability in the year, basically the biennium was ending, was not really reflective of the sources of revenue during the biennium as that apportionment factor changed.
Very good. Thank you very much. Is this bill ready to work, as far as you're concerned? Is the department ready on this one? We've answered your questions. We've dealt with the issues that the department raised. And this accomplishes the task that I ask you to work on. All right. I think we're ready. We're in work session on this bill.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to move, in as much as we are in work session, I'm going to move the -2 amendments dated 4/27/07 to House Bill 3048.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 3048. Is there further discussion?
Just one question, Mr. Chair. Always in the past, the cost of administering the distribution of the kicker checks has been borne by the kicker check itself. There is no additional cost being passed to the taxpayers here, as I understand it.
Vice Chair Butler, the administrative cost is dealt with in the refund for individual taxpayers. Under, you're only changing the corporate in this case, which is a credit. So
okay.
there's not a check mailed out.
So just that explanation. Thank you.
Right. So the administration here is handled in the usual way that we handle administration for corporate tax returns, rather than in some special way as we do for the check that's sent to individuals. All right, great. I'm getting nods all around. Obviously, we're agreed on that. Is there further discussion on the -2s? Because that's what's on the floor. Is there any objection to the adoption of the -2 amendments? Seeing none, the -2s are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3048 be moved to the House floor of the House of Representatives as amended with the -2 amendments with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Butler moves the House Bill 3048 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? I'll call the roll.
Representative
Durbin.
Aye.
Representative
Wren.
Aye.
Representative
Dalton.
Yes.
Representative
Dalton.
Aye.
Representative
Green. Aye.
Representative
Rosenbaum.
Excuse?
Representative
Clinch. Aye. The bill having received the required majority, the motion is carried and the bill goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who'd like to carry?
Representative Butler would be
delighted. Representative Butler would like to carry. I thought you might, Representative. Representative Butler will carry the bill. And with that, we'll close the work session. Thank you. And we have one more for today. Public hearing. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2294.
Mr. Chair,
if you like. You want to move for that? Representative Butler has a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the committee rules be suspended and that we reopen the hearing on the work session on House Bill 3048 to provide Representative Rosenbaum an opportunity to vote on the vote which was taken on House Bill 3048 as amended.
Representative Butler moves that the rules be suspended to allow Representative Rosenbaum to vote on House Bill 3048. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum votes aye. And with that, we close the work session on House Bill 3048.
Thank you.
And we open the public hearing on House Bill 2294. Chris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2294 modifies or makes some modifications to the credit that is allowed for fish screening devices. By way of context, the credit exists currently in law, and it is equal to 50% of the certified costs of the taxpayer, or $5,000. The bill changes the some qualifications for the screening devices that qualify for the credit, as well as making a number of changes to the fish screening cost share program, which is a way of splitting the costs for these devices between the state and the individuals. These changes, they expand the fish screening cost share program to include water diversions of any size, with preferences for diversions of 30 cubic feet per second or less. Currently in statute, there are two sets of statutes that pertain to device water diversions that are less than that amount and diversions that are more than that amount. And one of the things that the bill does is kind of clean up that language and eliminate some of that duplication. The bill also modifies the fish screening goal from 75 water diversions per year to 150 per biennium, allowing the department a little more flexibility there. It also adds a requirement that it be 150 cubic feet per second per biennium, so that allows a different kind of device to qualify for the credit. It requires installation if the water diversion is at least 30 CFS, a new water right is issued for the water diversion, or the point of water diversion is transferred. The bill also prohibits the payment of cost share funds for diversions involving water rights issued on or after July 1, 1996, unless the first fish screening task force finds good cause to allow an exception. With respect to the cost share program, in current law, there are dollar limits and percentage share limitations to how those costs are divided. The bill would eliminate the dollar expenditures of $10,000 for the department and $5,000 for the water diverter, but it maintains the percentage requirements, the 60-40 split between the state and the individual. The bill would require the department to be responsible for major maintenance and repair of screening devices at water diversions of less than 30 CFS, and would require individuals to be responsible for all maintenance of these devices at diversions of at least 30 CFS. It also authorizes the department to charge $150 per visit for inspection and maintenance of a bypass device if the owner fails to maintain it. In current law, that amount is $25. And it requires the department to notify a person, required to install, operate, maintain, repair, or replace a screening or bypass device, and allows that person to request a contested case hearing before a state fish and wildlife commission. With respect to the revenue impact, you have a draft revenue impact statement in your packet as well. Current credit, the annual impact of that is less than $50,000, and in the most recent tax year for which we have data, tax year 2005, fewer than 20 taxpayers claimed roughly $30,000 of tax credits on the personal side, and they were able to reduce the tax liability by about $20,000. And the bill doesn't change that the $5,000 limit on the credit or the 50% of the net costs that would qualify for the credit. It pertains to the various things that I've mentioned so far. So the revenue impact that I have on there is a minimal impact in terms of dollars.
Because the credit itself doesn't change?
Right, because the parameters around the credit in terms of the $5,000 limit, which is in page 5, lines 18 through 20,
those parameters for the credit are not affected by the bill. It's just the devices themselves, and it allows some more flexibility for some larger projects with going from a yearly limitation to a biennial, and the requirement for the 150 cubic feet per second devices that allows for some larger devices to qualify for the credit.
Okay. Thank you. We have two representatives of the department.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Gentlemen.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairs, my name is Roy Elliker. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. On my right, Mr. Ray Hartlerode, our Fish Feeding and Passage Program Manager. And essentially, this bill, 2294A engrossed, represents some lessons and changes the department's learned over the past decade in the statutorily created Fish Screening and Passage Cost Share Program. I do appreciate the very careful and reasoned discussion by legislative revenue staff in describing the changes, modifications of this statutory program. I have some prepared testimony I would briefly cover, Mr. Chair, and then, of course, I'm sure there'll be questions. Essentially, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has been in the fish screening and passage and the technical assistance side and construction side for many decades, essentially. But about 16 years ago, upon a 1989 report done at the request of the legislature stating that there's lots of problems with unscreened water diversions. And again, water diversion is a place where particularly a farmer, an irrigator, another water user is having to take water, surface water, out of a stream or creek or another something else. But without some physical impediment, some device called a fish screening to block fish from going down that diversion, many, many fish would end up getting lost to these diversions and out on the fields or ground up in hydroelectric turbines or whatever. So essentially, fish screening is a way to protect fish and keep them in the creek or stream or surface water diversion that the water's coming from. And these can be very large situations or very small. In many times, there is technical engineering involved, and for small diversions, usually not. But for the past 16 years, and starting back in 89, essentially, with the publishing of the report, an inventory of water diversions in Oregon needing fish screens, which documented over 35,000 water diversions where surface water was diverted from rivers and streams. In 91, a coalition of folks came together, fishing groups, irrigators, landowners, water users, and put together this 60-40 cost share. And essentially, the 60-40 cost share, the state provides 60% of the cost of helping a landowner or water user put in a water fish screening diversion structure, and the landowner provides either in-kind or cash is needed at 40% of that cost. And again, there's tax credits and other things involved. But in 1991, we had a pilot program that's authorized by the legislature. Many groups that you see represented today in the back of the room, everybody from the Farm Bureau, Association of Oregon County, Steelheaders, and others, all were involved in that. In 95, with some changes, the cost share program was made permanent by the legislature, and that is what kind of the statutes that we're asking for some changes of today. I think one of the key features of the statute, the current program that will continue with these modifications, is that there is a public advisory body that meets quarterly called the Fish Screening Advisory Task Force. It has three seats for agricultural and water users, and it has three seats for fishing interests and other groups, and a public member at large. And they provide quarterly advice to the department on project, on cost sharing, and on policies as well to the commission. So that kind of sums up kind of the history and where we're at with the program. If you look at the page two, it lays out the five major proposed revisions to the program the department's bringing forward. These were changes that we worked closely in the interim with many of the user groups on, and particularly the Fish Screening Advisory Task Force. And I think they've been laid out very nicely by legislative revenue staff. The change in the fish screening goals, which allows more flexibility in how the department measures success in the program. by allowing not just numbers of diversions, but also cubic feet per second to be used. The second one, authorization for water diversions of any size, again, allowing us to work with diversions of all sizes. However, there will be a preference for the less than 30 cubic feet per second water users in that. And primarily, there's always been a strong preference for small water diverters to be making sure that they get these cost share funds, and that will continue with the preference language. Number three, again, clarifying the statute to allow flexibility in actual amount of funds used for cost share to the water user, and also to allow the Fish Green program to make use of increased funding that is available. Fourth, clarify that the fish greening tax credit is granted to all water users installing fish greens that meet state requirements. And lastly, increasing a fee for inspection minor maintenance if needed from $25 to $150. Mr. Chair, that ends my prepared remarks, but I'd certainly like to take a few questions.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
And did your colleague have a testimony?
No, sir.
Okay. Representative Berger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know so little about fish screens, I almost hesitate to wade into these waters.
Please do. You may ask the question the rest of us are thinking.
No, this is the Revenue Committee, and so we look at numbers. The $150 per visit inspection,
yes, ma'am,
is only, as I understand it, if the $150 is only charged if they don't have the records that they were supposed to have kept in the first place? Is that my understanding of this?
Yourself.
Yeah, again, I'm Ray Harrod with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Fish Green Passage Program. Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger. Yes, that's only if, in the case of a water user does not do the minor maintenance or the major maintenance that they're required to do, so, and that they've agreed to do under our grant agreement with them. It's a stick that we hope we don't ever have to use, but there's been an occasion where we would need something like that to ensure that that minor maintenance especially is conducted so that the agency doesn't have to come back in and do major maintenance that we're required to do much sooner than normally would be needed.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yes, please.
I think what I'm trying to get on the record, and I think you've answered it, is that this $150 is not considered a fee increase or something that is trying to pay for something so much it is a stick or a carrot, as you say, to make sure that they do what their obligation is. Is that
That's
correctly
correct.
Characterizing it?
That's
Thank
correct.
I'm waiting out.
Thank you. Other questions? Couple of the issues that this committee generally deals with when it looks at bills that involve tax credits, excuse me, is that we have a committee rule that requires that the bill be accompanied with a statement of the purpose of the tax credit and a way in which we can measure whether or not that tax credit is being is accomplishing the purpose for which it was adopted. And I don't believe we've got that yet today, so if that would be something that I think the department may want to meet with staff of the Legislative Revenue Office to discuss to see how that can be done. Usually when working with departments of the executive branch, we don't ask them to measure something new. We ask them to go through the things that they're already measuring to figure out which of those measurements would be useful in determining whether the tax credit is meeting its purpose or not. So that would be one issue that I would raise. Another issue that I would raise is that there is no sunset of the tax credit in the current statute. When we look at bills like this, we generally try to add a sunset to the tax credit, the purpose of which isn't to get rid of the credit, but to make certain that the legislature reviews it at some reasonable period of time. So I think your input on what that ought to be would be also a useful thing as we proceed with this bill. Committee, have I hit the main issues that we are working on? And we're not picking on you. We're doing this on every single tax credit that we're considering with the hopes that we will be able to get governor's tax expenditure report into the kind of shape that it can actually be used as a policy, a driving device down the road. And we'll kind of formalize that a little bit. I think I've got it. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today for the public hearing on House Bill 2294? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2294. And I believe we've exhausted our agenda for today, and therefore we are adjourned. Thank you.